Brothers and sisters, if you don't change your ways, you are on the road to Jam Nation.
Editorial note, this episode was originally published to Spotify
on March 5th, 2023,
and has now since been re-edited to replace full songs with song clips in order to publish this on other streaming services beyond Spotify. There may be references in this episode to events and dates that well precede the episode publish date on any podcasting platforms that are not Spotify. And there may be references to songs which have since been replaced by song clips. I just don't want anybody to be confused. Now, let's move on to the episode. Enjoy!
Feels like kicking out all the windows and setting fire to this life. She would change everything about her, using colors far and bright, but all the colors mixed together to gray, and it breaks her heart.
Welcome back, everybody, to episode 15 of Road to Jam Nation. In this episode, I'm going to conclude the interview that I started last episode with music journalist Alan Light, who's a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominating committee. If you have not yet listened to that episode, I recommend you go back and listen to that first before continuing with this episode. And then, after my interview with Alan Light, I will conclude this episode with a rundown and my comments on the nominees for this year's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. And that analysis will continue into episode 16. I started off this episode with my intro music being from Dave Matthews Band, who is among the so-called snubs that I am going to be discussing with Alan in this episode. I hope you enjoyed that little musical segment. And now, let's go ahead and continue listening to that interview that I did with Alan.
As anybody who listens to my show knows, I'm a jam band guy. So I'm definitely was kind of interested in the case of Dave Matthews Band, who was the only winner of the fan vote that did not get inducted. Yeah. And then he hasn't come back up for nomination again. So do you have any idea, was he close at all? Or do you have any idea?
I genuinely don't know what that voting looked like. I can't speak to it. Personally, just speaking for me, I would like to see them get another shot. Hopefully with the new album and the tour this year, there'll be,
it'll be another number one album, and it'll be another well-attended,
and it'll be the eighth and, straight number one album, and it'll be the,
and everybody that loves Dave Matthews is going to be happy, and everybody that hates Dave Matthews is gonna still hate him. That is where it is.
And I will certainly say that it's not like it dropped off and hasn't come up, you know, since then and just disappeared. As you noted, as we brought in more younger voters that are voters, as more of the sort of 90s artists have started to go in, I think, you know, somebody like DMB should get another look as the voting body has evolved and see and at least get the temperature. I will say that part of the reason that I was, you know, supportive, one of the things that I really liked about getting Sheryl Crow onto the ballot this year was, you know, as I mentioned before, I feel like the post-punk stuff really sort of didn't get it. It's starting to sort of shake out a little bit, but still feels a little scattershot to me of who's gone in and who's hasn't and who's gone back to ballot and who hasn't. And I feel like that, you know, certainly that sort of what became Lilith Fair, that movement of those women in the 90s who, you know, transformed, you know, a lot of things. Alanis had the biggest album, but you can't put them up against each other or nothing's going to happen. Cheryl, you know, if nothing else, I mean, in addition to the things about her, she is, I think, certainly the one who came up out of that generation and has really sustained, you know, over decades, this really successful and remarkable career. And at least to me, if you're looking at the Hall of Fame, in the end, to me, you know, the Hall of Fame is about, are you telling the story of this music?
Right.
That is the only thing that this is about, is when you look back across this, if these are the names that are there and somebody is trying, some kid who wants to like, what do I need to know there? And what are the gaps? What's missing that represent all of this mosaic, all of this story? And I feel like Cheryl, the most interesting thing to me, and I love her, but the most interesting thing to me is she sort of fills in at least that spot.
Right.
On the quilt, here's a woman. So if you even just go back to her story, then you see, oh, okay. And then there were all of these others that were also doing these things at the time and how they changed, right. You know, what that was. And you're not going to get, you know, in a short period of time, you can't say, okay, you know, Cheryl and Alanis and Fiona and Tori and Bjork. Right. And, you know, it's right. that becomes a long-term project, but at least it sort of puts a pin in, you know, here's a thing. And Matthew's sort of, as you said, as the sort
he's
of
the
second,
most commercial,
second wave,
the 90s
yeah, second jam wave band. Jam band, yeah. You know, yeah. Culture.
Fish is obviously the kings right. of that, but much less commercial impact, much like the Grateful Dead, you know, they were more of a fan driven thing. Obviously, you know, their history and stuff like that. And as influence goes, vast majority of those 90s jam bands were trying to follow the lead of Fish as much as they were the Grateful Dead. So yeah, to me, they are obvious, but I also understand that it's a hard sell, given that they haven't had huge, you know, radio right. type of impact. And if you're not into jam bands, most people hate them. So I get that. But to have their name come up in the room at all, Fish?
You know, again, I want to be cautious about all of this. Everybody we mentioned here has at least one way or another gotten mentioned.
Thing I gotta say, I was predicting Sheryl Crow this year when, you know, I am on that forum and I threw out my prediction. She was one of my ones going into the year before the Rock Hall ceremonies. I was leaning more Alanis Morissette, but I was thinking along those same lines of, you know, the Hall trying to get in more women and we're moving into the 90s. To me, Alanis Morissette is the more innovative and probably more influential artist, but she's a little bit more flash in the pan as far as the length of her commercial success. And then Cheryl has just consistently put out hits. So I kind of saw either one. I was leaning more towards Alanis, but I kind of felt like during the Rock Hall ceremony probably didn't do her any favors with at least a certain segment of people that are making those decisions.
Yeah, maybe so. That influenced any of the thinking at this stage of the game at all. I mean, I think people think about that a lot of like, oh, but they're not going to sell tickets at the induction. Like, I none of that. Is yeah. part of this, you know, this discussion at all. Yeah. And I think that's a fair, I mean, I think that, you know, that's a thing that we sort of said before, there's a constant question. Alanis was like bigger, but, you know, narrower, right. Where Cheryl was, you know, she didn't have the biggest album of the 90s, but she's still, right. You know, but she never sort of stopped being right. that kind of a rock star. So, you know, those are both valid arguments. You know, I like the idea of just making sure that, again, that movement, and I don't want to denigrate it as like a separate thing, but, you know, it certainly is a moment in rock history when that alternative women community right. sort of came to the fore. And that would be, I think, a good, you know, a good piece of the story to recognize.
Thank you, India. Thank you,
Steven Van Zandt's still in the nominating committee, so I know that there's at least one person still throwing out some of the older 60s names and stuff like that. But this year, really, the only two nominees that were active in the 60s were the Spinners and Willie Nelson, and neither of them really were recording hits back then.
Willie Shore wrote some back then.
Yeah, he wrote a ton of them, but yeah, as a recording star, you know, his big impact came in the 70s and 80s. You know, the Spinners were kind of just tilting at windmills until they converted to the Philly sound. So basically, those are the only two that are really that old. There are no others. So should we kind of be expecting that for the most part, the 50s and 60s are done outside of those side committees?
I think it's inevitable. Those bands have had a lot of opportunities to be looked at. Right. And again, what is there something new? Is there something that's going to change their story?
Right.
That would escalate And that could happen. You know, again, a big reunion thing, a big, again, all of those things, a documentary, a placement that results in a hit. The Spinners, you know, honestly, the Spinners have gotten on the ballot a few times before. I think that the reason that back this year was because when Tom Bell died a few months back, I think there were a lot of us who went back to those records, you know, in considering what his career was and that he was the primary producer and writer on that amazing run of Spinners records. You know, I know that that's what I listened to the next couple of days and was like, God damn, these records are spectacular. And yeah. I will say I'm not super optimistic about them, you know, being able to get up and over and getting in there. But I think there was, another look that was given to those records because of that. So
they don't have a lot of competition on this particular ballot.
Right. And they're sort of alone in that lane. I think at this point, for a band that's really, if an act has had 20 or 30 years of eligibility, you know, either not gotten enough votes on the committee to get nominated or then not gotten enough votes to get in, there's got to be something that's going to alter that story, you know, for there to expect a particular year shows that who knows what can happen, who knows what lightning bolt has gotten enough votes to get in. There's got to be something that's going to alter that story. You know, for there to expect a particularly different outcome. What we saw with Kate Bush this year shows that who knows what can happen, who knows what lightning bolt can strike and transform the way that we think about a career of some of these artists. You know, but again, I just think you have to think about how many times at this point a band from, you know, the 50s, they've had 30 bites at the apple here. What's the reason that that something different is going to happen? Again, and then there's the other committees and the other ways that they could still get in. So
not really in the bailiwick of the nominating committee per se, but one other area of controversy over the years has tended to be which band members do and don't get included in the inductions. And we've seen adjustments made after the initial nominations. We've actually even seen some people added to bands after the actual induction ceremonies that weren't listed at the time. So whose actually job is it to go out and make those decisions?
You know, I wish I had a better, that seems like a negotiation between the, really, I think the board and the people who put the event together, I don't know, and management. And as we know, again, there's not a perfect solution to this issue. I have no insight for even what the nominal outlines are supposed to be for the way that this is done. I mean, as just in your head, every one of us would say that has to be case by case.
Right.
And, you know, I would hope that there are consistent guidelines and parameters. Clearly, they're not 100% universally consistent, that's for sure.
What's caused the controversy, yeah.
I'm happy to have plausible deniability about how all that stuff works.
I respect your music knowledge enough to say, you know, Alan would probably get that right.
And I know that there are some of the committee members and some of the, you know, I think at least through the first pass, because through the first pass, those names do go on the ballot.
Right.
As you've said, there have been modifications that have been made, but somebody is making the call there for, you know, how they are being presented. So I think that there are good hearts and minds working on that. But again, I'm clear of getting that wrestled into shape.
I will say that I personally have been, you know, pretty complimentary of what I see as pretty progressive attempts by the nominating committee to fix so-called holes in the Hall of Fame and stuff over the years. It's really more of the main voting body that still drags their feet on some stuff. So I was kind of wondering, you know, they've been starting to try and use the side committees more often and kind of expand their focus. Was any thought ever put to just saying, okay, the nominating committee gets to choose one or two people that they just actually just going in and all the rest of these will go on the vote so that if they see actual historical holes in the story that the Hall is telling.
We've always fantasized. At some point, somebody comes up and says, like, we should just make the list and that should be the end of it. I don't think that's going to happen. And I don't think that that's ever been discussed. You know, look, I certainly don't want to denigrate. The voting body is, you know, an awfully accomplished, you know, whatever you call it, a gathering institution. Again, the biggest block of voters are musicians who are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And the rest of them are, journalists and industry people. And I mean, these are informed voters. It's not like they're just randomly selected knuckleheads to cast those votes. So, you know, I never want to disparage what it is that they bring. I think they take their job seriously as well. I just think obviously the more that you open the lens, the more that the bigger names are going to benefit from that. The familiarity is going to matter because you're across a lot of different genres and specialties. And, you know, that's just, that's the nature of what it is. So as a voter, what I choose as my top five is certainly not what ends up lining up with the ones who go in. Sometimes not even close, right. But I think that's just the nature of what this is. And that's why, like I said, sometimes I think it's important for us on the committee to say, okay, these guys didn't get in this time, but we're going to stick with it because we really believe this is important. And maybe by next year, they'll say, oh, okay, I guess that those guys really think this pick belongs, and it'll pick up some more support. And that's the thing I do want to also make sure to get in is, you know, we should mention the fan vote. And I know that a lot of people say it's useless and it's stupid and it counts as only one vote. But to me, there's two things that are important about the fan vote. One is what it means to the artists, because they always do end up talking about it, talking about the support that they get. But the other is, I think that voters, the rest of the voters, look at the fan vote. And if you see, I guess, that this artist really has this huge following and groundswell and passion, that factors into how you think about them when you're coming up with your final votes. I think that that does resonate. I think that voters do look at it and think, wow, I guess there's a lot more support for this band, or they still connect a lot bigger than what I might have expected. And that can be the difference, that can tip the balance when you're thinking about what those final five that you're choosing are. So I think it's bigger, it's louder than just that one vote in the pool.
I was a little interested this year, since they combined 2 years this year, you know, after the whole year got messed up by the pandemic, and we wound up going from like 25 years to 26 years for a couple of years. So you guys wound up surprising kind of the Hall Watcher community by combining the artists of 1997 and 1998, which is how the White Stripes got on there. That nobody, I think if people knew 98 was going to be on this one, that would have been a big prediction. I think that's an obvious one. But it did also wind up immediately creating new big name snubs, in that I'd say the three biggest names I saw on that 98 list would be Coldplay, Lauryn Hill, and Britney Spears. So those all have now officially been eliminated from the chance of first year nominations, as far as, and not that I'm particularly a fan, it's just those are definitely big names that I wouldn't be surprised to see on the list at some point.
Well, you're right. We were, you know, finally realized that we had to catch up on. It used to be that we would meet in the fall and then the ceremony would be in the spring. And then pandemic shifted everything to meeting early in the year and the ceremony being in the fall in November for these couple of years. And in that, we jumped over a 6 month and, you know, we had to catch it up somewhere. I hadn't particularly noticed that. I think we were just scrambling so much to be able to keep all the wheels turning that we hadn't thought that through. And then as a result, you have, I don't know if it's twice as many, but essentially twice as many newly eligible artists, but you don't have extra slots on the ballot. And so, you know, some of that is you end up with some inevitable conflict, you know, most obviously from that list, Missy and Lauren, I think would be an issue to try to put on the same ballot. I think that, you know, we do try to be cognizant of, again, people only have five votes. So if you're putting two that are really sort of similar time, genre, whatever, do you really think you're going to get two votes out of the five? And so I think that it crashed into that a little bit. So yeah, maybe as far as the Vegas odds on the first timers, it threw things off, you know, but I think it was right rather than staying at a permanently at a lag and saying it's 25 years, but then it's actually really 26 years, you know, at some point we'd all figure that out.
One name that I think that I've been wanting to see, he's still around, but he's definitely getting up there, is Herbie Hancock, with the thought being that, you know, Miles Davis is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I think that's completely right, because that whole jazz fusion stage was Miles Davis's attempt to do rock and roll. And it definitely had a humongous impact on 70s rock and roll, jazz fusion, you know, my jam band stuff that I love. Herbie Hancock was part of that band, but then Herbie Hancock goes out and makes the Headhunters, who have a huge impact on funk music. Yeah. And then he comes out with Rocket and Future Shock, which introduces turntablism. So if we're putting hip hop in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Future Shock brings turntablism to the mainstream. So to me, he seems like an obvious big name that's been overlooked.
And then wins the Grammy for the Joni Mitchell project.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Well. I mean, his career is, I mean, when we're talking about, you know, people like that, you know, Nina Simone and stuff like that, it's like, to me, you know, in my world, Herbie Hancock seems like a big mess right now.
You make a good case. I don't feel like it's a thing that we've talked about, and maybe that truly may be, you know, more something that's a musical excellence type of a case to make. I'll mention in the spirit of my own, of just because you asked about who else, well, there's two on like this that I push for on the musical excellence side. One of them is Carole Kaye, yes. Because I don't like this. Some of the Wrecking Crew are in, but yes. Some are not. And Carole Kaye is still around and alive, and any bass player in the world would induct her. And that one drives me crazy. It seems like a very easy win.
Probably the single most influential bass player in history, if you look at all the pop songs that she was a part of.
Single most influential, not named James Jamerson. But, absolutely. And as a woman in that world, like I that one I really would love to see. And this was actually something that initially came in as a listener suggestion. And I thought about it, was like, they are 100% right. I think the Wailers should be in.
That was me.
Was that you?
Yeah, that was me.
I can tell
that's
you that
how I, that's how that. I texted. That's how I got started texting with you, was on my argument that the Wailers should get the same treatment.
I am 100% in agreement. There was that year that a lot of the Anthas went in. The Blue Caps went in, the Miracles went in, the Crickets went in. But, you know, obviously Marley is at the absolute pinnacle of any kind of Hall of Fame. Right. But there is a single band that created the sound that the world knows.
There were other members at the start, and even
you know, and it's the cheat.
He wasn't out front just playing an acoustic guitar to everybody. There were Junior Marvin and the i3s and all those other ones.
And all those amazing players. Music. And again, it's a backdoor way to get Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer in, even, you know, if that's what will do it.
If it goes in, so be it.
Names go on the wall.
They're not around to accept it anymore anyway.
I can tell you that I did put that out to the higher ups. I 100% agree. I think that's a really, really good call. Like I said, I would like for, you know, more communication between the different committees so that at least there could be more discussion. But those I would really like to keep, you know, knocking on the door for.
Yeah, when I made that call, there was a lot of other names, but that was been my big one. So, you know, in the back of my mind, I had some of the other ones too, but, but you know, I didn't, you know, you're on a radio show. It's like, you don't want to try and dominate the whole time. You know, there's a ton of other people. I tried to throw that out there, and I'm glad it actually took some headway. I hope people listen to it, because I think it should happen.
Yeah. Know that it's getting its hearing. That's all that I can do.
Yeah. far as early influence at this point, since we've redefined that, I kind of think Chubby Checker should probably be thrown in that. If we're putting dance pop in the Hall of Fame, he was kind of the original dance pop artist. And it always seemed weird to me that he never even got a single nomination, even though it's not necessarily my go-to music. It's, right. It's pretty obvious what.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of history there. I know that he was really, you know, vocal and angry about not being, I think, sort of, you know, immediately and initially put into the Rock Hall. It's a lot of discussion that predates me. And so I don't know if it's settled business or not.
Seems like the time has come right. and gone for that to happen through the normal process.
Right.
So it is what it is. As far as other, you know, I'd also mention Lee Scratch Perry for musical excellence.
For sure.
He's as much known as his production work as he is for the Upsetters, or probably better known for production than
Yeah.
And then Toots and the Maytals as early influence would make sense to me too.
As early, you know, yeah. I mean, there was, and I'll say it's, I do feel like there have been times when that's been discussed as certainly that would be the next, who would be the next reggae act that you would look at. Yeah, I don't, I mean, look, there's, you know, there's so many endlessly worthy and excellent, and I'm a huge, huge fan, you know, would wholeheartedly support it. Like I said, it's not the same thing where my fight has been for the Meters. It sort of feels like in a sort of a similar zone, but this is the thing, right? Said every year there's 50 names that come in, give or take. Every one of them, there's a really smart person making a really convincing case for, you know, less than a third of those then go to the ballot, and less than a third of those, or about a third of those, then end up going in, you know, which to back that out leaves you with, you know, 45 names that were brought up, plus who didn't get brought up, plus who then comes in eligible the next year. You know, that's why I said there's all you can do is take your best, you know, and your most sort of open-hearted shot at what that might look like, because in the end, there's no winning.
Right. I think at this point, I'm as we've moved into the MTV era, I'm utterly in fear of at some point, you know, the Specials or Madness showing up on a ballot, even though they weren't as big in America as they were in England, but I could see them showing up on the ballot. And if they're on the ballot and Toots and the Maytals aren't already in, and maybe even Prince Buster or something like that, it starts to have a little bit of an uncomfortable racial overtone to it.
Yeah, I certainly understand. And again, I don't think that the Specials are or any of those ska bands are sort of, you know, sure locks that walk in all.
They're a little bit more niche. I get it.
But it does get you back into that, like, if there were somebody and they were huge and could go in, you know, how hung up do you get on the, but it should be in this order?
The Hall was smart enough to put Muddy Waters in before they put the Rolling Stones, you know, and back in the day,
hey, the luck of those 25 years of eligibility was worked out there. Yeah. But I think those, you know, certainly those things need to be kept in hip hop world, in hard rock world, and some of these other things where, you know, you do know that it's going to be a more limited, you know, everybody that's worthy is not going in. Yeah. Certainly in the immediate future, and you really have to pick your spots. Okay, then what's the best version of that story that you feel you will be able to tell, that feels like it has a shot? And standing up and beating your head against the wall for a lost cause doesn't, in the end, you know, doesn't advance anything. So you want to keep the playing field and the context, you know, in mind for, you know, how you want to lay the cards out.
We're going to pause the interview again here and listen to Toots and the Maytals, and then we'll be back for one last segment of my interview with Alan. Please enjoy.
One other really old name that's never come up, but seems like an early influence under the new terms, might be Dick Dale for surf rock music.
I have to text somebody back about Dick Dale, unrelated. Yeah, I'm interested to see what will happen with the early influence stuff, because like I said, early influence did mean this one thing for a long, long time. Again, I would love to see it this year because of all of the focus on this. There's all this focus on the 50th anniversary of hip hop. Right. It was a huge Grammy tribute, the 50th anniversary of hip hop. Why is it the 50th anniversary of hip hop? Because what everybody points to as the beginning was DJ Kool Herc having this party in the basement of his building in the Bronx on this date in 1973. And it's the first time that we know of somebody, you know, cutting and scratching pieces of records.
Right.
Should not Kool Herc be an early influence?
Right.
If we're designating that as the birth of a genre. And I've said it repeatedly, and this would be the absolute year and moment. I mean, it's not announced. I assume that we're going to be in Brooklyn this year. By rotation, we would be. That's not official, but that's if by the math, that's what it would be. Like, again, does that not seem like an absolute clean win for everybody to do that?
Makes sense.
But that's not my end of the operation. I can say that I will plead the case. The point being how that thinking about early influence evolves, you know, early influence on what? Early meaning, not meaning pre-1950, but meaning pre-creation of this genre or this style or whatever it is, that's early, I think is really good and healthy, but feels like we're sort of just starting to see that change.
Right. So Dolly last year, Willie nominated this year.
Yeah.
To me, if I was picking a next in line, if Willie goes in, my thoughts tend to go to Kenny Rogers as being multidimensional household name. And actually, in Kenny's case, he actually had a rock and roll phase.
Right.
So, any thoughts on that?
I mean, he, like I said, I guess he went in the Country Music Hall of Fame, which again is such a way even more difficult elite process than it is. So clearly, is sort of taken seriously at that stature. I got to say, one I'm going to be really interested to see how it plays out is Garth.
Yeah, that was my follow-up, was Garth and Shania.
Just
two artists that wound up transcending the country genre. And Garth is a rock star in concert.
And Garth is so rock and roll inspired, and as, the biggest selling solo artist, like whatever it is. I mean, I'm obsessed with all of that stuff, but nonetheless, I think that there should be an interesting conversation around Garth. I don't know. So when it's been Dolly and Willie, and these are, again, if there's debate about Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. There's no debate about the excellence. These are, untouchable icons in terms of their body of work. I think Garth has made some great records, but that's a different, that's somebody who's a sort of a different figure in the landscape. But hard to argue that he wasn't culturally transformative. And, got his Rolling Stone cover and whatever, a lot of those sort of looking at the, the boxes that you look at. So that is one that I've certainly been thinking about. I'm not sure how I feel about it. I don't fully know. I mean, I'm a country listener. I'm a fan. I get it. It would make a fan vote go crazy. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. My taste in country, I'm a country boy. I grew up in rural America. So I grew up around country music, but I've never been, even when I was a kid, I was never a big fan of the more commercial Nashville style. My dad listened to the honky tonk country and the old school country. So that's what I have more of an affinity for. So I will admit, when Garth was making his big break, I was kind of turning up my nose, but I've seen videos of his concerts and stuff like that. I totally get it. Would I rather that those spots be taken by, more my style music? Yeah, I understand it's a big tent.
And it's almost a different argument. I mean, it's nominally the same category, but it's a very different argument than if you're going to argue for, Buck Owens or those sorts of figures. I don't have a definitive answer. I don't even have a definitive answer, like I said, about my own feelings about it. But I think it's a really, it's an interesting case. That's a stay tuned.
'Cause I got friends in low places where the whiskey drowns and the beer chases my blues away. I'm not big on social graces, just think I'll slip on down to the Oasis. So I've got friends.
One of the biggest ongoing one, of course, is with a lot of the kind of more commercial rock, you know, what they used to call, you know, corporate rock bands and stuff. And the perception always used to be because, you know, Rolling Stone magazine critics and stuff were very involved in the process, that those were the bands being snubbed because they weren't to the taste of Rolling Stone. Now it's more, seems to be moving into an era where MTV executives are more in the lead at the Rock Hall, which in some ways, you know, since that seems to have made things a little bit more populist, would seem to maybe open up a lane, because some of those artists, Foreigner, REO, stuff like that, they did have a lot of success on MTV in the early days. But at the same time, the other thing where the Rock Hall seems to be really, you know, trying to broaden and make sure that the definition stays diverse. What do you think are the chances for some of those bands that Trunk Nation and stuff are yelling about, at least on the more commercial stuff?
I think it's obviously it's still a tough sell. And others will say this is my own bias or my own, you know, my perspective, and that's fine. To me, there's one question that it always comes down to, really, for, you know, anybody that we're considering, to me, is like, how did they change the game?
Right.
Like, what is the thing that they do? How is music, like, what is different before and after this artist is there? And is that just through something different that they did, or something that they crystallized, or something that they represent? But, I feel like pretty much you can point to, you know, all of these nominees, or, you know, most of these nominees. I'm not 100% in lockstep ever with exactly what the ballot is, but fine. And there's a thing that you can say, this is what they did. This is the thing that it's not just, oh, they were good. You know, case is just, they made some songs that that's great. You know, and that's a baseball player who's a career, you know, 275 hitter who, you know, hit 15 home runs a year. Would you want that guy on your team? Sure, you'd want that guy on your team. Is it a top 1% Hall of Fame career? There's got to be something that takes that over into a different category. And I look at those bands, this is personal, this is not institutional, but, you know, I look at those bands and I can't really point to, like, how are things different because, you know, REO Speedwagon was there, or one of these other bands was there. They had hit records. Some like them more, some like them less. Even if you're a really big fan, I want to hear that argument, because that's, you know, to take it full circle, that's what we have to sit in that room and do.
Right.
Is in a couple of minutes argue, like I said, if we're telling the story of this music, here is what this act did that, you know, leaves a lasting impact and somehow changed that story. Mm-hmm. And for whoever your band is that you're mad isn't in, like I said, I have plenty of them. We all have plenty of them. But that's what I ask you to think about, is what's that argument besides just, you know, they were really cool and I listened to their records a lot. I don't discount that at all. There's nothing I love in the world more than fans.
Right.
Like, there's nothing better than the people who really believe in their artists like that. That's great. I'm not saying that doesn't matter.
If the band changed your life, it's hard to tell that person that that band wasn't influential.
Right. Wasn't transformative.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you look, again, if you're looking at this history, what's the case you're going to make? What's that story? If you got one and you really, you know, have it, then fair enough. Then you're allowed to feel some injustice and I'm there with you. But if you can't really come to that, or you can't strongly enough come to that, then, you know, again, it doesn't mean the band was bad.
Right.
It's just, what then are we talking about for a Hall of Fame status? I said, it's not an exact science. We would love it to be, would make everybody's life easier.
We're kind of coming up on your time. Let me just throw out one name that, as far as if we're going with my taste and what I want, I will say I was very disappointed. I really thought that this was going to be the year for the B-52s with all the publicity from their final tour. Yeah. So I will say I was really bummed to not see them. And as far as transformational, I think they fit that. As far as diversity, they fixed that. They have women. They've got their gay icons. I think they check all the boxes.
I think there was some momentum around them this year, and I wouldn't say that it's over. And these aren't fair, and I'd have to go back and look at the full list. I do think it's not a straight up either or, but I think Cyndi Lauper you know, does make it a, did make it a little, you know, that's, that was a little bit of a block.
Yeah. As far as, again, it's a female artist, you know, gay friendly artist.
A little bit later, it's visual, you know, it's a thing. And obviously they don't come at the same moment. I know they don't, it's not the same story. It's not
the same career arc. Yeah. The career arc and stuff like that. Yeah.
You know, but like I said, there's, and I can't say this for, this was what the thinking was in terms of the nominating voters and all of that. But again, you do want to be, you know, somewhere in your brain cognizant of, you know, am I setting up a situation where neither of these get in or none of these three get in? Right. Because, you know, there was a year, a couple of years back where, and I guess it was the one other time that Iron Maiden was on the ballot, where Maiden, Priest, and Motorhead were all on the ballot. Is that right?
I remember there being...
There were three.
There was, yeah.
I can't remember if it was Maiden. It was Motorhead.
But it was
Priest.
Definitely Motorhead. Motorhead
and Priest, and maybe Thin Lizzy.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Something
and
like.
I you know, I mean, it was how the vote fell, and I'm like, okay, it's fine, but you're guaranteeing that this is not going to work out, because what are you asking voters to do at that point?
That's the metal fans are going to vote for all of them, but the ones that are more in other lanes, when they've got four names down, they're going to, you're going to look and go, okay, well, let me.
Even the ones that are open to it, even the ones who get like, okay, we should have more metal, we should have more hard rock bands in here.
You're going
to
split.
Like, I get it and it's fine, but now what are they supposed to do? You're not, you know, and so I do think sometimes, and they're year by year cases and all of that stuff, but, you know, you do want to look at, is there something else that is, you know, occupying too much of that spot? That it doesn't serve the purposes of moving any of them forward.
Okay, so you've been more than kind with your time at this point. So before I let you go, do you have any parting words for my audience or anything else you want to plug that you're doing?
I think I've given the speeches that I want to give about all of this. Look, as you know from the radio, I won't say I welcome the disagreements, but you know, what it says to me is people care about it and that it's, you know, that it's important. I would much rather that people argue and fight with it than don't care about it at all.
Right.
So, you know, I do feel like that means, you know, somebody's doing their job well. I have issues with the process. I have issues with the selection. Every single person does. I've always felt I would rather be inside and working on it than like outside and complaining about it, you know, and know that voices do get listened to. Like I said, even the fan vote, as much as it can feel like it's insignificant, people are paying attention to what it is that it represents. All of that stuff does resonate. So when I was editing magazines, if you would do a top 100 whatever list, you would measure it by the amount of, you know, angry mail that you got. Like that was a success.
Right.
If it was so safe, you know, that everybody was like, yeah, okay, and it's just boring, that it wasn't good. And if it was, and if it was so dumb that they didn't even care or didn't even want to respond, that was no good. So if you look at it enough to think, there's something here, but what about this or that? And you're engaged with it. Just if you look at that ballot and put yourself in the voter's head, if there are five things you can vote for that you would feel are really strong candidates, that's the job. Right to the Trunk Nation voters this year. I don't know what the anger's been, but if you have a ballot and you can vote for, you know, Judas Priest and Rage Against the Machine, and now I don't have the list in front of me, so
Soundgarden for sure.
There's Soundgarden.
Most of them will probably vote for White Stripes, although I can hear the griping that they're getting nominated so fast. I was having a hard time, even though Sheryl Crow is definitely rock. I was having a hard time looking at it, going, okay. Who's the five that Eddie Trunk's going to vote for? I was having a hard time figuring out who his fifth vote was, but
that could be Sheryl Crow. That could be Warren Zevon.
Yeah, he might. He probably.
That would be my guess if I'm guessing. Yeah,
he'd probably vote for Zevon. I think I've heard him speak highly of Zevon.
I think that, you know, that's somebody who, like, within the rock world, they have to give up the respect for. So, you know, that's not 100% your ballot, but I'm not going to be voting 100% for my ballot either. That's not it's not about batting 1,000. It's a long game. And, you know, you got to think much bigger picture than that. So I think as we've talked about, addressed a lot of the sort of territories that needed to be represented. And there's a lot that still need a lot more work. That's why you show up next year and the year after.
Thanks a lot, Alan.
And that's going to conclude my interview with Alan Light. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed my conversation with him.
And now let's listen to the B-52s. And then after this musical segment, I'll come back and I'm going to begin discussing this year's nominees for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Enjoy.
We were at a party. Earlobe fell in the game. Someone reached in and grabbed it. What the rock lobster?
Let's go ahead and discuss this year's nominees for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The nominees for this year were announced at the beginning of February, and this year's list contained a total of 14 different acts that are nominated for this year's induction ceremonies. That slate of 14 candidates has been sent out to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame voters, which is a pool of over 1,000 people, the biggest portion of which are existing members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and then that is augmented by music journalists and industry people, record executives and, you know, publicists and, you know, other people that are in the music industry that get to vote on this. Of the 14 nominees this year, 8 of them have been nominated for the first time. And those are Cyndi Lauper, George Michael, Sheryl Crow, Willie Nelson, Warren Zevon, Joy Division and New Order, who are nominated jointly, and we'll get into a discussion of that later, and then Missy Elliott and the White Stripes. And in the case of Missy Elliott and the White Stripes, both of them are nominated in basically what is their first year of eligibility, although there's a little bit of weirdness that I noted there during my interview with Alan Light, in that this year for first-year eligible nominees, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame actually considered everybody who had their debut recording in 1997 or 1998. So under the old calendar, Missy Elliott would have been eligible last year because her first recording came out in 1997. But last year, they did not consider the first year eligibles from 1997. As noted in my interview with Alan Light, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame calendar got messed up a bit by the coronavirus, skewing everything by an extra 6 months or more. And now the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is trying to catch up so that they get back to the standard of people being eligible for being nominated 25 years after their first recording, which this year obviously would be 1998. And 1998 was when the White Stripes released their first single. So they were eligible this year as well. So those were the first time nominees. In addition to that, there are 6 nominees that have been renominated that were on previous lists but have not yet been voted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And those would be A Tribe Called Quest, Iron Maiden, and Soundgarden, and all 3 of those are appearing on their second ballot. And then Kate Bush and The Spinners, both of whom are now on their 4th nomination, and Rage Against the Machine, who are on their 5th. So I'm going to spend some time going over kind of the resume and the arguments, you know, mostly the arguments in favor of these artists. I may point out some personal opinions on them if I feel that maybe the honor isn't deserved for one reason or another. But for the most part, I like to highlight the reasons why they most likely have been nominated. And I'm going to do that roughly in seniority order, based on how long the artist has actually been eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So let's go ahead and start that with Willie Nelson.
Whiskey River, take my mind. Don't let a memory taunt you be. Whiskey River, don't run dry. I all I got, take care of me. Whiskey River, take my mind. Don't let a memory taunt you be. Whiskey River, don't run dry.
Willie Nelson's first recording came out in 1958, which technically made him eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame since 1983, although the Hall didn't start inducting acts until 1986. So Willie Nelson has really been eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame from the moment that it was founded. But this is his first nomination.
And part of that is because, other than country music acts that had a noted rockabilly phase, until Dolly Parton got in last year, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame hadn't inducted any pure country artists, except for those artists that they had inducted as early influences on the development of rock and roll. Those early influences were acts such as Jimmy Rogers or Hank Williams. Johnny Cash, of course, is thought of primarily as a country artist, but he did start his career as part of the Sun Records roster of rockabilly stars. There's also Linda Ronstadt in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and Linda definitely did some fairly straightforward country music as well as some country rock music. But the thing with an artist like Linda Ronstadt is that she was never shy about exploring the boundaries of any genre, and she was never willing to be pigeonholed into a single genre. And so, in a case like hers, she really transcends genre. I myself am an advocate for a big, broad Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because, as I noted in my last episode, the Rock Hall started out deliberately trying to build its definition of rock and roll on the very diverse definition that had been used by DJ Alan Freed. And that's just simply to point out that, once again, I do believe in a broad definition of rock and roll. But even with my pretty open-minded look of what can be encompassed under the term of rock and roll music, I do personally think it's a mistake for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to induct people from genres that pre-existed rock and roll music, unless those people wound up integrating rock and roll into their sound at some point. So, for instance, while I think the world of Joan Baez, folk music preceded rock and roll, and Joan Baez was never one of the many folk musicians who ever really tried to cross over and integrate her sound to a more pop or rock-based audience. She always focused pretty exclusively on being a folk musician. So I personally would have rather seen Joan Baez be inducted as an influence on rock and roll, because there's no doubt she was a highly influential singer and performer, but she was never a rock and roll star. So I do think that inductions such as that do vary a bit from what I think should be the charter for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I kind of apply that to Willie as well. I absolutely adore Willie Nelson, and there's no doubt that his songwriting and his overall personal persona has been massively influential on rock and roll, as well as a number of other genres of music. But Willie never tried to play rock and roll. He was always a country star.
Cowboys like smoky old pool rooms and clear mountain mornings. Little warm puppies and children and girls of the night. Them that don't know him won't like him, and them that do sometimes won't know how to take him. He ain't wrong, he's just different, but his pride won't let him do things to make you think he's right.
So anyway, last year the Hall inducted Dolly Parton, who became the first truly pure country singer to be put into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a performer. Dolly was never somebody that had a rockabilly phase. She had a little bit of pop crossover success and some crossover into the easy listening charts, but she has always been a country artist through and through. And even she admitted when she was inducted that she was not a rock and roll star. So while I adore Dolly Parton, I think it was a mistake for her to go in as a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame performer. I personally am fine with rap being in the Hall of Fame. I'm fine with modern dance pop being put in the Hall of Fame. I'm fine with easy listening R&B like Lionel Richie going into the Hall of Fame. But I think it's a mistake to open up the Rock Hall to pure country performers. Country rock? Sure, I'd say put them in. That was an evolution that happened after rock and roll started. But the performers that stayed purely country performers, I just don't see it. And while it is hard for me to complain about any honor that Dolly Parton can get, I'm more worried about the precedent opening it up so that a whole string of country performers start going into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, further shoving aside people that have been pursuing rock and roll. So anyway, Willie Nelson, following on Dolly Parton's heels as a nominee, is something that it seemed like everybody was kind of expecting once Dolly Parton went in. Willie is a huge pop cult icon, and he certainly transcends the country genre for sure. But Willie Nelson never tried to be a rock and roller. He made roadhouse honky tonk music for sure, and he's played traditional country swing, and he spent time recording traditional jazz style pop standards. Is Willie Nelson's songwriting influential? Absolutely. Is his persona influential? For sure. But Willie Nelson never was and never will be rock and roll, even under the broadest definitions of the term that I could come up with.
If I made you feel second best, girl, I'm sorry I was blind. But you were always on my mind. You were always on my mind.
Go ahead and put Willie Nelson in the hall under the musical excellence category. Put him in as an influence. But in my opinion, he should not go in as a rock and roll performer. And I personally think that the Hall is simply trying to set a precedent so they can eventually induct Garth Brooks and Shania Twain and get some eyeballs on their TV ceremonies. And while I mentioned that I dislike the precedent for putting in country performers because it may squeeze out many of the guitar rock bands who've been snubbed for many years, I think it's also very likely to also squeeze out some of the more edgy and innovative and influential alternative music stars in this day and age when country music is now more popular than rock and roll music as a radio format and modern commercial genre. At one time, the Hall of Fame was known for giving preference to musical innovation over commercial pop cult appeal, but that trend has been very much being reversed in recent years. And I think that's just highlighted by these huge pop cult icons like Dolly Parton going in and Willie Nelson being nominated. So I said just a bit ago that Willie Nelson's first recording came out in 1958. Actually, looking at that, I misremembered. His first single came out in 1957, and that single was No Place for Me, which was not a hit. Willie Nelson did not have a ton of success as a performing star early in his career. His big success came as a songwriter. Willie's first actual country music hit was the song Willingly, which was a number 10 song on the country charts in 1962. He didn't record a song that crossed over onto the pop charts until 1975, when he released Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, which was a number one song on the country charts and crossed over to be a number 21 hit on the pop charts. All in all, Willie Nelson has recorded 57 songs as a solo artist that became country music hits, including 12 number one songs on the country charts.
So leave me if you need to. I will still remember angel flying too close.
And he has also participated in 26 country hit songs that he did in collaboration with other artists or as a guest vocalist on other people's singles. And 12 of those collaborative hits were also country number ones. 10 of the songs that Willie released or was a part of have crossed over onto the American pop charts. The biggest one of Willie's career as a solo artist was the number 5 pop chart hit for his song, Always On My Mind. And he also had a number 5 pop chart hit with his collaboration with Julio Iglesias for To All the Girls I've Loved Before. And Willie was also part of the big celebrity all-star charity recording, We Are the World, which of course became a big number one hit when it was released. Willie's most recent hit single came out in 2019, and that was when he covered Creedence Clearwater Revival's song, Have You Ever Seen the Rain, in collaboration with Willie's daughter, Paula. That recording managed to just squeak into the country charts at number 36 in 2019. March of 2023 is featuring Willie Nelson's 99th career studio album, either as a lead artist or as part of a collaboration with another artist. In addition to those studio albums, Willie's also released 14 live albums, and there have been 56 compilation albums released that collect Willie Nelson's music. And he's also released 2 movie soundtrack albums, one of them for The Electric Horseman and the other one for Honeysuckle Rose. Willie's first album came out in 1962. His first album to cross over beyond a country audience was his outstanding 1975 album, Red-Headed Stranger, which was an album that went to number 28 on the overall Billboard albums charts. Willie's biggest success on the album side was in 1982, when his album, Always On My Mind, went to number 2 on the Billboard album charts. Among his many albums that went to number 1 on the country album charts was his soundtrack album for Honeysuckle Rose, his 1981 Greatest Hits album, and the compilation album The Wanted, The Outlaws in 1976, which was a collaborative album of Willie and a number of the other big outlaw country stars of the time. Also going to number 1 on the country charts was a 1978 live album, 13 solo albums, and 2 collaborative albums that he made with Merle Haggard, and 1 of his collaborative albums with Waylon Jennings. As far as considering the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame key qualities, as far as innovation goes, there's no doubt that Willie was an innovative songwriter and a fairly unique guitar player.
It's been so long now, but it seems now that it was only yesterday. Gee, ain't it funny how time slips away?
As far as overall impact, Willie Nelson has absolutely transcended genre. And at this point, Willie is basically as much of part of American culture as the 4th of July itself. Willie's influence is massive, with fans and disciples in multiple genres. If we consider Willie from a musical excellence standpoint, he absolutely fills that in. He may be pretty famous for he and his band playing fairly loose and ragged, but he is absolutely an excellent musician that can stand his own playing with any other musicians on earth. As far as my own personal thoughts, I love Willie, but like I said, despite all these accolades, I don't think he should be in the Rock Hall of Fame as a performer. Put him in as an influence. Put him in for musical excellence. I don't think he should be a performer. But as far as his chances of actually making it in now that he's been nominated, I think they're extremely high, unless more people start having second thoughts on this whole new direction of the Hall of Fame with these massive country pop cult icons. Dolly Parton got in last year, but apparently just managed to just barely squeak in. But part of that could be the fact that Dolly Parton so publicly said that she didn't think she deserved the honor. I don't think Willie Nelson has made any comments one way or the other that I've personally seen. Certainly no reactions that got nearly the amount of publicity as Dolly Parton's reactions last year. As far as if Willie Nelson was to actually get inducted, there's no real drama to be concerned with other than the fact of whether or not Willie will be healthy enough to attend the ceremony. Willie still plays live quite regularly, but he has also had to cancel quite a lot of shows in recent years due to his health issues. So that would be the one question, is whether or not Willie is going to be physically up to performing at the ceremony or not. And that's something that'll just have to be discovered as the time gets closer. Looking at possibilities of who might do an induction speech for Willie if he was to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I'd say take your pick. I kind of would put the odds-on favorite, though, as being his smoking buddy, Snoop Dogg. Because let's face it, Snoop Dogg's going to draw some eyes to this ceremony. But you could also get massive stars like Garth Brooks, who would also bring a lot of eyes to the TV show. And if I were to guess at what songs Willie might perform if he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I will note that Willie Nelson has always been a master at doing medleys of his big hits. If you go and see him in concert, there's always a segment when he will perform a quick medley that runs through a lot of his big hits. So it wouldn't be surprising at all to me to see Willie pack in say, 10 different songs in a 15-minute set. But if I were to choose just three songs, I'd say On the Road Again is absolutely a must. Whiskey River would seem very probable, even though that song was not a Willie Nelson original, but it is one of his live landmark songs that you always expect him to play. And while the song is better known for Patsy Cline's huge version of it, how could Willie Nelson not play Crazy? It's still the number one jukebox song in all of music history. So that's my thoughts on Willie Nelson. Let's go ahead and listen to Willie now. And let's play On the Road Again. Enjoy.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again. Going places that I've never been. Seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again.
The next nominee for this year's Rock Hall is The Spinners.
Baby, whenever you call me, I'll be there. Whenever you want me, I'll be there. Whenever you need me, I'll be there. I'll be around. I knew just what to say. Now I found out today.
The Spinners have been eligible since 1986, the year that the hall opened. And this is their fourth time being nominated for the Rock Hall, with their previous nominations having come in 2012, 2015, and 2016. Over the years, there's definitely been a bit of turnover in the membership of the Spinners. And those kind of group changes can often create certain controversies in the Rock Hall with the members that wind up being included and members that wind up being excluded. In the case of the Spinners, I think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame pretty much got it right. They've nominated all of the members of the Spinners during their 70s heyday when they had all of their big hits. Some of the members that were part of the foundation of the Spinners in the 50s and the 60s were not nominated, since none of those members were part of the group during their hit-making phase. And newer members of the group that have filled in empty slots after members have left the group or died have not been included, and once again, none of those newer members were involved in recording any of the Spinners' notable songs. So in this case, I think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame got it right. One unfortunate thing with the membership of the Spinners, however, is the fact that there is only one surviving founding member of the band that is still performing with the group, and that is Harry Fambrough. Harry still tours with the Spinners, and there certainly would be a Spinners group to perform at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but he would be the only member that's actually being inducted. Members of the Spinners that would be inducted if they do get voted in include Harry, but also Billy Henderson, who was a founding member of the band in 1954 and continued to perform with them until 2004, and then wound up dying 3 years later in 2007. Purvis Jackson, who was a founding member of the group in 1954 and continued to perform with them until his death in 2008. Bobby Smith, who was also a founding member in 1954 and continued to perform with the group until he died in 2013. And then a non-founding member is Philip Wine, who was a member of the group from 1972 to 1977. And so while he was not a founding member, he was very much a part of the Spinners' most famous recordings. Philip unfortunately died in 1984, 7 years after he had left the group. There are two members of the Spinners that were foundational members, C.P. Spencer and James Edwards. James Edwards was only with the group for a very brief time at their beginning in 1954. And C.P. Spencer left the group in 1956, which is before they started recording at all. George Dixon was with the group from 1956 to 1963, so he did appear on some of their earliest recordings, but left before they'd had any commercial success. Edgar Chico Edwards was with the group from 1963 to 1967, which once again was during their struggling years. And then G.C. Cameron was with the group from 1967 to 1972, leaving the group just as they were on the cusp of their big breakthrough success. And then John Edwards was a member of the group from 1977 to 2000, joining the group after their period of their biggest success. Other more modern members of the group that have filled in slots as group members have left include Frank Washington, who was with the group from 2003 to 2007, Harold Spike Bonhart, who was with the group from 2004 to 2009, and Charlton Washington, who was with the group from 2007 to 2020. And then there are current members of the group, Jesse Robert Peck, who's been with the group since 2009, Marvin Taylor, who also joined in 2009, Ronnie Moss, who joined the group in 2013, and newest member, CJ Jefferson, who's been with the group since 2020. So none of these more current members of the band are being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But if the band is voted in, most likely they would show up at the ceremony to help support Harry Fambro in doing an induction performance of a few of the group's songs. With the origins of the Spinners dating back to 1954, the Spinners really are the longest established nominee for this year's list, although their first recording came out after the first recording of Willie Nelson. The fact that the Spinners are really the oldest band on this year's list of nominees may very well get them some extra votes from some of the older members of the Hall of Fame. However, as I noted, the Spinners' real success came in the 1970s. And 1970s R&B has been having a hard time getting much traction with the voters. So I'm not sure if this year will work out any better for the Spinners than their three previous nominations did. But there's no doubt that they're kind of alone in a lane, and that very well might help them as well.
You play with love as though it's a game, leaving a string of broken hearts, heartbeat stopping. But soon the day will come, then you'll learn the love that you waste. You're gonna need it again and again and again. Well, baby.
The interesting thing is that while the Spinners are seen as one of the key bands in the development of the Philly soul music sound of the 1970s, the band actually began as a young vocal group in Detroit in 1954. And their 1960s recordings were made for Detroit labels, Tri-Fi and Motown. Tri-Fi wound up being bought out by Motown, which is how the group was transferred to that label. The Spinners had a few small hits with Motown. They had two low-level top 40 hits, a number 27 hit in 1961 and a number 35 hit in 1965. And both of those songs made the R&B top 10. And they had one other number 16 R&B hit in 1966. But that was about it for their commercial impact. But the group became popular with audiences for their live shows at the Apollo in New York City. And the band wound up making ends meet by working various odd jobs for other Motown acts, such as being drivers, road managers, and they also worked in Motown's shipping department. The Spinners switched to Atlantic Records in the early 1970s. And that change of labels invigorated their career. After more than a decade of recording without a single top 10 hit, the Spinners' very first Atlantic album contained two top 10 hits and a number 11 hit. And all three of those songs went to number one on the R&B charts. The success of the band was masterminded by producer Thom Bell, who was one of the key producers of the Philly sound in the 1970s. And it is due to the influence of Bell that the Spinners are a group from Detroit that is now seen as part of the Philly soul genre, and indeed is one of the most successful groups of that genre.
Once there was a boy and girl, boy said, you so. Girl said I never leave you. They grew older and left each other, 'cause that's the way love goes. That's the way love goes.
The Spinners wound up having 7 top 10 pop hits during the 1970s, including a number one hit song that they did in collaboration with Dionne Warwick, which was the song Then Came You. Overall, the band wound up having 34 hits on the R&B charts. They had 18 top 40 pop hits, with their final hit coming in 1995 as a featured performer on the rap version of their song, I'll Be Around. Before that 1995 rap feature, the band's last chart hit had come in 1980 with a medley single that combined the song Cupid with I've Loved You for a Long Time. The group's other big hit songs include I'll Be Around, which was a number 3 pop hit in 1972, Could It Be I'm Falling in Love, which was a number 4 song in 1972, Games People Play, which was a number 5 song in 1975.
I walk around, I can't hear a sound, folks talking loud, but I don't see at all. I gotta get away, gotta get away. I don't
know where to go. It's hopeless, so I guess I'll leave it alone.
Well, I spent all that day fixing up to go somewhere.
And my favorite song from the group, The Rubber Band Man, which was a number 2 song in 1976. The group would also hit number 2 on the pop charts with their cover of the Four Seasons song, Working My Way Back to You, in 1979. The Spinners recorded 16 original studio albums between 1961 and 2021. The group achieved 5 consecutive gold albums from 1973 to 1976, and 2 of their albums wound up being top 10 Billboard albums in 1975 and 1976. Those albums being New and Improved and Pick of the Litter. The group released 4 live albums, and their 1975 live album charted in the top 20. 13 compilation albums have been made from the group's music, although none of those compilation albums have been huge commercial successes. Looking at some of the criteria for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, if we look at innovation, then the Spinners had morphed over the years and wound up becoming one of the major bands of the Philly sound in the 1970s, although, as I've already said a couple of times, they weren't originally a Philly band. As far as commercial impact, the group struggled early in their career, but they had that huge 3-year period in the 1970s. So the group had an impressively long career, but their period of success was definitely a flash in the pan in the middle of that long story. As far as the group's influence, personally, I'm not sure that anybody was especially influenced by the Spinners so much as they were the Philly sound of Thom Bell. As far as considering musical excellence, the Spinners are certainly outstanding singers with a good number of catchy hits. As far as longevity, that is certainly the biggest mark in the favor of the Spinners. Since the group started in 1954, and there's still a version of them out there performing now, almost 70 years later. As far as my personal thoughts on the group, I like a handful of the Spinners' songs quite a lot, but the majority of their catalog to me is a little bit generic. So I'm not a huge fan of the group. As far as their overall chances of making it in, as I noted, I think they've got a decent chance this year simply because they've got so little competition. There's so little music that really competes with them for their style on this year's ballot. But other than that, I'm not sure a lot has changed in the world to give them a hugely better chance than the other 3 times that they were passed over. As far as any possible drama with the Spinners, I really can't imagine that the current version of the group wouldn't take advantage of this opportunity to promote themselves by appearing at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremonies. And since only one of the nominated members of the band is still actually alive, there certainly will be no drama around any possible reunions that could or could not happen. As far as who might induct the Spinners, Questlove, who's on the nominating committee, has certainly been all about trying to get the Spinners into the Hall of Fame. But based on past history, Questlove doesn't seem to like to actually do induction speeches. So I'm thinking perhaps they could get Daryl Hall to do it for them. And then if the band does get voted in, then if I was to choose three songs that I think the band might perform, I would say Rubber Band Man for sure. And then Could It Be I'm Falling in Love seems obvious, and I'll Be Around as well. Let's go ahead and listen to Rubber Band Man now by the Spinners. Enjoy.
You and me, we're going out to catch the latest sound. Guaranteed to blow your mind so high you won't come down.
Here you are, prepare yourself for the Rubber Band Man. You'll never heard a sound like the Rubber Band Man. You're bound to lose control when the Rubber Band starts to jam.
Oh, boy, this dude is out of sight.
Next up on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominations is Warren Zevon.
I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for the place called Lee Ho Fook's, gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein.
Warren Zevon was the son of a Ukrainian immigrant, a Jewish man by the name of William Zevon, who worked as a bookie for the Los Angeles-based Cohen crime family. And Zevon's mother was a Mormon of English descent. The family name was originally Zividovsky before it became Americanized during the immigration of his father. As a young boy, Warren Zevon studied classical music under the instruction of famous classical composer Igor Stravinsky. And Warren wound up leaving high school to pursue folk singing in New York City at just 16 years of age. Zevon wound up forming a duo with a high school friend of his, and the two of them wrote and recorded his first minor hit under the name Lime and Sybil. The song came out in 1966 and was titled Follow Me. The song had regional success and climbed as high as number 65 on the Billboard pop charts at the time. To support himself as he tried to build his own performing career, Warren Zevon wound up making money as a songwriter for others and also writing commercial jingles. And he also worked frequently as a studio musician on other people's recordings. Warren Zevon's solo debut album finally came out in 1970, and that album flopped. So he wound up having to continue making his living in other ways. And he spent the early 1970s as the musical coordinator and the keyboard player for the Everly Brothers touring band. In 1976, with the help of Jackson Browne, Warren Zevon recorded his first album for a major label, which was a self-titled album. Jackson Browne worked as the producer and helped to publicize the album. Linda Ronstadt was impressed with the songs and wound up recording a number of covers of the songs off of Zevon's album. And Linda Ronstadt's fame helped to bring Warren Zevon some more attention. But despite the support of Jackson Browne and Linda Ronstadt, Warren Zevon's self-titled album wound up topping out at only 186 on the Billboard album charts. However, the album was greeted with rapturous reviews in the music press. In 1978, Zevon released his biggest album, which was titled Excitable Boy.
Well, he went down to dinner in his Sunday best. Excitable boy, they all said. And he popped a pop roast all over his chest. Excitable boy, they all said. Well, he's just an excitable boy. He took in the 4 a.m. show at the Clark. Excitable boy, they all said.
In addition to the Excitable Boy title cut, the album also contained his famous song, Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and his most popular song, Werewolves of London. And it also contained his popular song, Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner. After this 1978 album, Warren Zevon continued to record to mostly critical acclaim, but never again really met with outstanding commercial success. He continued his career with his songs being better known for popular cover versions by other artists than for his own original versions. Later in his career, in 1984, Warren Zevon would collaborate with most of REM to put out music under the band name Hindu Love Gods.
Overall, Warren Zevon is much more of a respected songwriter with a cult following for his own music than he is a major household name in his own right.
When my mama met my girl, she took me aside. She's a soft-spoken woman, but she speaks her mind. She said, nothing come between you. Don't let nothing come between you.
Most casual music fans, if they know his name at all, likely just think of him as a bit of a one-hit wonder for his Werewolves of London. Zevon released 12 solo studio albums from 1969 to 2003, along with two live albums. And there's been 6 compilation albums of his music. And then, as I noted, he put out the one album with the members of REM under the name Hindu Love Gods. That 1978 album that I mentioned as his most successful one, Excitable Boy, went to number 8 on the Billboard charts in 1978 and was eventually certified platinum. His first Greatest Hits album wound up achieving gold level sales status. His 1980 album, Bad Luck Streak and Dancing School, went to number 20 on the Billboard charts. And his final album, released in 2003, went to number 12. Werewolves of London would be Zevon's only top 40 hit as a performer. It went to number 21 in 1978. His next closest attempt at a hit was the song A Certain Girl, which in 1980 topped out at number 57. As far as the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame criteria go, as far as innovation, Warren Zevon is thought of as one of the most ambitious singer-songwriters of the 1970s, with a knack for injecting his satirical social commentary into his songs with a remarkable dry wit.
I was walking in the wasted city, started thinking about entropy, smelled the wind from the ruined river, went home to watch TV.
As far as impact goes, as I mentioned, he had much more success in his career as a songwriter for others than for his own commercial performance. As far as influence, Warren Zevon is beloved by many musicians. He's one of those type of people that tends to be seen as the favorite songwriter of much more famous songwriters. As far as musical excellence goes, without a doubt, Warren Zevon was usually a major favorite of musical critics for the music that he made. He's well known for sophisticated and interesting lyrics and for wide-ranging musical arrangements.
Every day I get up in the morning, go to work, do my job. Let's have a mini surrender. I need some sentimental hygiene.
As far as my own personal thoughts, I love Warren Zevon, but I'll admit, I'm not quite sure he belongs in the Hall of Fame over a number of other singer-songwriters of his generation that have not yet gotten in. I know John Prine was nominated a few years ago, and as much as I like Warren Zevon, I think John Prine is a much more influential and important songwriter, but he was not able to make it. As far as Zevon's chances of making it in, I'd say it's at least 50-50, because on the one hand, I think he definitely has the votes of a lot of fellow musicians. He had a lot of famous musicians that supported his career, and a lot of them that have been calling for his nomination for the Hall of Fame. As Alan Light noted in his interview with me, Billy Joel himself had sent a letter this past year to the Hall of Fame asking that they consider nominating Warren Zevon for Hall of Fame honors. Zevon worked with and was friends with a bunch of the people who were in the Hall of Fame. And over the years, the Hall of Fame voters in general have tended to love and induct songwriters. But I did note that the Hall of Fame had recently passed over the chance to induct John Prine. And much like John Prine, Most of Zevon's songs are better known for their cover versions by other artists than for his own versions. As far as drama goes, well, Warren Zevon unfortunately is dead, so there's no real drama there over whether or not he would show up. The interesting thing would be what they would do for a possible tribute performance for him. I'm quite sure that the members of REM would willingly perform as a backing band for anybody that they found to do the lead vocals on some tribute songs for him. As far as ideas for some possible performers that could do his songs, I'm thinking perhaps Jackson Browne would do it, or perhaps Dwight Yoakam, or if they really want to spike the viewing on their Hall of Fame induction, they might be able to convince Bruce Springsteen to come out and do some of his songs. All of those are well-known performers who are among the many guest stars that appear on Warren Zevon's final album. As far as who might induct Warren Zevon if he was inducted in the Hall of Fame, the most likely candidate would be David Letterman, who's been a very vocal proponent for Zevon in the Hall of Fame and has done past induction speeches at the Hall of Fame. So I would be rather surprised if David Letterman was not tapped to induct Warren Zevon. As far as the songs that they might play in his honor, I'd say obviously Werewolves of London, because that's his biggest song. Lawyers, Guns, and Money, which despite not being a big hit when it was released, has gone on to have a pretty good shelf life. And also the song Excitable Boy. I'm going to play Lawyers, Guns, and Money for you now. And this song is going to wind up ending this current episode. Please join me again next week when I will continue going over the 11 other nominees for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and playing samples of each of their music as well. As always, if you want to get a hold of me, you can send an email to tony@roadtojamnation.com. Or if you're on Facebook, you can join my Facebook group, also titled Road to Jam Nation. It's a public group open to anybody, and you're welcome to post any comments, complaints, criticisms, or questions there. Thanks for listening. Now let's listen to Warren Zevon. Enjoy!
I was gambling in Havana. I took a little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this.